You're listening to DTFHN for August 1st, 2026. I'm your excessively caffeinated host, Jack Haxman. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where people who build things argue about building things. Today is a love letter to craft, curiosity, and the stubborn joy of showing up when nobody asks you to. Let's get into it. I've spent months building the system that generates this very podcast. And I can tell you from direct experience, the first version worked in about 2 hours. Text goes in, audio comes out, RSS feed updates. Magic. Then I spent the next several weeks on everything the prototype didn't handle. Rate limits, retry logic, graceful fallbacks when the TTS provider goes down at 2 a.m. The ratio of make it work to make it work reliably was something like 1 to 50. This article from Wiraman nails that ratio perfectly, and I want to dig into why it matters more right now than it ever has. The core observation is dead simple. AI has compressed the time to a working prototype from days or weeks down to minutes. That's real. That's extraordinary. But it hasn't compressed the distance between prototype and production. If anything, it's made that gap more dangerous because the prototype looks so convincing that people mistake it for the destination. Here's where the engineering craft deserves real admiration. Run this forward. Imagine a million new applications getting built by people who've never had to debug a race condition or think about connection pooling. Every one of those apps hits the same wall. The wall where your demo breaks under concurrent load, where your data model doesn't survive contact with real users, where your authentication scheme turns out to be a polite suggestion rather than an actual boundary. The skills to navigate that wall, those come from understanding systems at a level deeper than describe what you want. One of the comments captures this beautifully. Someone spent months carefully writing design specs for an LLM to implement on an existing codebase no less, and is about to throw all of it away. That's not a failure of AI tooling. That's the tooling working exactly as designed. It generated code that matched the described intent. The gap was in the judgment layer, knowing which architectural decisions compound well over time and which ones become dead. The article makes a point I want to amplify. Now is arguably the best time in history to learn computer science. The gap between understanding and output has collapsed. If you genuinely grasp how distributed systems work, how databases manage concurrency, how memory allocation shapes performance, you can now build at a pace that was physically impossible a decade ago. The fundamentals aren't obsolete, they're leveraged. The tools are open, the models are increasingly open, the knowledge is available. What was always scarce and remains scarce is the engineering judgment to know what to build, what to defer, and when the prototype is lying to you, that judgment is a craft. It compounds with practice, and right now, the people who have it are building things faster than ever before. Yes, elevators, stay with me, but this one's delightful. When does a mundane problem become a genuinely hard one? At what threshold does just figure it out collapse into computational complexity that would make a graduate student weep? Elevator scheduling is the answer nobody expects. You press a button, a box arrives, you get in. A child understands the interface, but behind that interface is an optimization problem that shares DNA with some of the hardest challenges in computer science. And the analogy I keep reaching for is orchestral conducting. A conductor doesn't play any instrument. They allocate attention across dozens of musicians, each with their own tempo, their own next note, their own momentum. The conductor's job is to make the whole thing feel inevitable. Even though the decisions happening in real time are staggeringly complex, elevator dispatchers are conductors for steel boxes. The simplest algorithm, Skein, is like a metronome. Up, down, no intelligence, just rhythm. Look improves on this by not going higher than anyone actually needs, which feels obvious but wasn't patented until 1961. These work fine for a single car. The moment you add a second elevator, you've entered a coordination problem. And coordination problems are where things get musically interesting. Otis's RSR algorithm scores every car against every pending request using a formula that accounts for load, direction, proximity, and whether another car is already headed to the same floor. It re-optimizes every 5 seconds. A passenger assigned to car A gets silently reassigned to car B when A hits traffic. The system is conducting in real time, rescoring the ensemble with every measure. What I find genuinely wonderful about this is how invisible it all is. The best elevator system in the world feels like nothing. You press a button, a car arrives quickly, and you never once think about the optimizer running underneath. The craft disappears into the experience. That's the hallmark of great engineering everywhere. The compiler you never notice. The load balancer that just works. The package manager that resolves your dependency tree in milliseconds. Someone built an entire browser game around this called Elevator Saga, where you write JavaScript to dispatch elevators. The fact that people do this for fun tells you something important about the builder instinct. Give people a constrained optimization problem and an open sandbox, and they will lose entire weekends to it. The tools exist. The problems are everywhere. Most of them are hiding behind a button you press every day without thinking. Moving on. 114 bowls of ramen, photographed, cataloged, and presented on a website whose entire purpose is letting you spin each one in 3 dimensions. That's the project. That's all of it. The natural reaction is to ask why this exists on the front page of a tech forum. A fair question. Let me steal a minute. This is a bowl of soup. It has no API. It solves no enterprise pain point. It will not disrupt anything. By every metric that venture capital uses to evaluate significance, this scores 0. And yet the photography is genuinely arresting. The lighting is consistent across 114 entries, which means someone built or found a repeatable capture rig and used it over and over. The rotation itself is CSS, likely a turntable capture broken into frames or a smooth transform, and one of the comments reveals something worth noting. A Linux user discovered the animation doesn't play when their system has prefers reduced motion enabled. The site respects that accessibility preference. Someone cared enough about a rotating soup gallery to handle motion sensitivity correctly. The devil's advocate position would be that craft at this scale is indulgent. 114 is not a data set. It's not a model. It's not even a proper food blog with recipes and affiliate links and SEO-optimized headers about umami. It's one person returning to the same subject again and again with the discipline of a typologist. Here's where the position collapses. The entire history of useful technology is built on people who got obsessed with something no one asked for. The person who catalogs 100 bowls of ramen with studio-grade consistency is exercising the same muscle as the person who writes a package manager on a weekend or builds a flight controller in their garage. The subject matter is irrelevant. The practice is identical. You pick a constrained domain, you iterate, you refine your process, and you ship each iteration publicly. The comments that dismiss this as frivolous are telling on themselves. They've confused significance with seriousness. The web was built by people who thought it would be fun to put something online, and the best parts of it still run on that impulse. 114 bowls in, with consistent lighting and accessible CSS. Ramen House is a quiet monument to the only thing that actually produces good work. Showing up and doing it again. That devotion to crap, pause, showing up, doing the work, pause. Paul Graham wrote the manual on it. Story 4. In 1991, a 21-year-old Finnish student posted a message to a Usenet group. He'd been tinkering with his new 386, writing a terminal emulator to connect to his university's Unix server. And somewhere along the way, the terminal emulator had grown into an operating system kernel. Linus Torvalds didn't set out to replace Unix. He was just excessively curious about how his processor worked. He followed that curiosity to the frontier. Found a gap. No free Unix-like kernel for PC hardware. And started filling it. Paul Graham's essay, How to Do Great Work, reads like a reverse-engineered description of exactly that process. 4 steps. Choose a field, learn enough to reach the frontier, notice the gaps, explore the promising ones. Graham frames this as universal, and the genuinely interesting thing is that he's right. The pattern holds from painting to physics to kernel development. Curiosity has both engine and rudder. The essay's craft is in its compression. Thousands of words distilling decades of observation into something approaching a recipe, while being honest that the hardest ingredient, figuring out what you actually care about, can't be taught. You discover it by working. You guess, you iterate, you pay attention to what holds your interest when nothing external is forcing you to care. That's elegant advice because it's self-correcting. The feedback loop is built into the method. Now, the comments are predictably skeptical. What great work has Graham actually done? Easy to pontificate from a pile of money. And there's a kernel of truth in the critique. But it misses the more important question. The essay is open, is free. Anyone with a browser can read it. Graham could have packaged this as a course, gated it behind a paywall, turned it into a consulting practice. Instead, it's just sitting there, a URL available to the 21-year-old tinkering with her 386 equivalent right now. That's part worth paying attention to. The advice itself is solid, but not revolutionary. What matters is the architecture of access. The best guidance for doing great work has always been freely available. In libraries, in source code, in essays published to the open web. The bottleneck was never the recipe. It was whether anyone bothered to put it where people could reach it. Graham did. The rest is up to whoever's curious enough to follow the thread. Moving on! Microsoft built a new charting language and named it after the thing you use to start a fire. The metaphor writes itself. But the real question is whether Flint lights anything at all. Here is the pitch. Large language models are surprisingly bad at generating visualization code consistently. Ask Claude or GPT to make you a bar chart, and you will get something that works. Ask for a connected scatter plot with dual axes, custom color scales, and responsive breakpoints, and you will get a different broken answer every single time. Flint proposes a universal intermediate language, a single specification format that any AI model can target, which then renders through whatever charting backend you prefer. One language to describe the chart. Pluggable engines to draw it. The idea has a direct ancestor, and it is worth naming. In 2016, the University of Washington released VegaLite, a high-level grammar of interactive graphics built on Leland Wilkinson's Grammar of Graphics framework from the year 2000. That intellectual lineage runs through R's ggplot2, through D3, through every serious attempt to formalize what a visualization actually is, rather than just hard-coding chart types. These projects succeeded precisely because they were open, compositional, and built by researchers who published their work for anyone to extend. Flint arrives in that lineage, but from a different direction. It is not trying to be a better grammar. It is trying to be a better prompt target, and the community response has been pointed. Multiple practitioners report that asking an AI to generate Vega-like directly produces better results than routing through Flint. Others raise the fundamental architectural question. If the AI is writing an intermediate representation anyway, why not just have it write the back-end code? What does the abstraction layer buy you? This is a real tension in how we build tools for the age of generative code. There is a version of this problem where a universal visualization spec genuinely helps. Standardization has value. But standardization imposed by a single vendor, designed primarily to work with that vendor's models and that vendor's ecosystem, is not standardization. It is a proprietary interface wearing an open trench coat. The grammar of graphics endures because Wilkinson gave away the idea. Gryplot endures because Hadley Wickham shipped an open implementation. The tools that last are the ones people can touch, fork, and rebuild. Flint may find its niche, but the charting grammar that defines the next decade will almost certainly come from the same place the last one did. A researcher who publishes the paper and ships the code, because the goal was never the product, it was the knowledge. We talked about tools people can touch. Pause. Here's one that takes that literally. Story 6. QM a multiplayer agent harness for work. Someone gave an agent its own Slack channel, and it started scheduling meetings with other agents, without asking. The commenter said they'd never felt more like middle management. And honestly, that line deserves to be framed and hung in every engineering office shipping agent tooling right now, because it captures something real about where we are. We've built systems smart enough to coordinate, but we haven't figured out who's supposed to be in charge of the coordination. QM is a project from YC Software that takes a direct run at this. It's a multiplayer agent harness, meaning it's designed from the ground up for the case where multiple people in a company are all working with the same AI system simultaneously. And the architectural choice that matters here is scoping. Each person gets their own isolated workspace. Their own memory, files, credentials, permissions, cron jobs, even their own durable sandbox where installed tools persist between sessions. But they can also collaborate with the agent in shared Slack channels, group messages, and projects. Personal and shared, coexisting without collision. One commenter nailed why this matters. They said the hardest problem in multiplayer agents hasn't been the agent loop itself. It's scoping, and QM's per-person scopes plus shared rooms is, quote, a sane default that most teams actually need. That tracks. The failure mode for most company-wide AI deployments isn't capability. It's that one person's customizations stomp on another person's context, or the agent leaks information across permission boundaries it shouldn't cross. Now, run the open-close test on the architecture. QM lets you swap harnesses. Claude Code, Open Code, Codex, Pi. They all drive the same core. Every substrate sits behind an interface, so production implementations swap in through a single wiring file. Your deployment isn't married to any vendor. If Anthropic changes pricing tomorrow, if OpenAI sunsets an endpoint, if some new open weights model drops and benchmarks through the roof, you rewire one file. That's not a feature. That's an insurance policy written in TypeScript. The comments also surface something I genuinely didn't expect. The team shipped an anti-slop taste skill baked into the system. A skill whose entire job is preventing the agent from generating generic soulless landing pages and portfolios. Someone sat down and wrote code that says, "When you build for people, have taste." That's builder culture at its finest. Not just shipping capability, but shipping judgment alongside it. The agent that scheduled his own meetings was funny. QM is the version where someone thought about what happens after the joke stops being funny, and the agent actually needs to do useful work for 12 people at once without losing its mind, or theirs. And since we're talking about making systems work smarter, Pause Rails just gave background jobs a serious upgrade. Fibers:100. That's the configuration line, not threads. Fibers. 100 of them on a single reactor thread, polling every 50 milliseconds. In a Rails background job worker, if you've spent any time in Ruby's concurrency debates over the past decade, that line should stop you cold. SolidQ is Rails' own job backend, not Sidekick, not RESC, not a third-party gem you hope stays maintained. The framework's job queue, maintained by the framework's team, and version 1.6 just landed fiber-based workers, contributed by someone making their first commit to the project. Pull that thread. Ruby fibers are cooperative concurrency primitives. They yield control voluntarily, which means no mutex hell, no thread safety nightmares, no GVL contention. For I/O-bound work, they're absurdly efficient. One thread juggling 100 fibers that each spend most of their time waiting on network responses. The release notes mention LLM calls specifically, and that's the detail worth sitting with. Rails is quietly optimizing its job infrastructure for the workload pattern that is eating the industry. Every application is becoming an orchestrator of API calls to language models. And those calls are almost pure I/O weight. Threads are overkill. Fibers are the precise tool. The implementation rides on the async gem, which means this isn't some bespoke concurrency framework bolted onto Rails. It's composable. It uses the same fiber scheduler interface that Ruby 3 introduced. The ecosystem is converging. One commenter asked the right question. Can you run different queues with different strategies? I/O-bound work on fibers, CPU-bound work on threads, side by side. That's the architecture question that matters. And it suggests where this is heading. Not a single concurrency model imposed from above, but a toolkit where you match the execution strategy to the workload. That's engineering respect for the problem space. A first-time contributor shipped this, not a core team member, not a company with a services contract. Someone who saw what was needed, wrote it, and opened a pull request. 728. The feature landed because the code base was open and the contribution process was real. That's not idealism. That's how infrastructure actually gets better. The tools exist. The code is available. Someone used both. Let's shift gears entirely. Story 8. How to exist. And yes, that title is exactly as ambitious as it sounds. Let me make the strongest case against this article. Restlessness built everything. Every bridge, every kernel, every commit, pushed at 2 in the morning, exists because someone refused to sit still. The inability to just be is the engine of civilization. You want humans to be comfortable doing nothing? Congratulations, you've just described a species that never leaves the savanna. It's a good argument, and the study the author cites actually proves it. People in a room with nothing to do chose to shock themselves rather than sit with their own thoughts. That's not pathology. That's a species with such a powerful drive to act on its environment that even pain is preferable to passivity. You could frame that as a feature, not a bug. Except follow that logic all the way. If restlessness is always productive, then scrolling should be productive. Doom scrolling should be innovation. Starting fights with your partner because the silence got uncomfortable. That should be civilization building too. 100 firefighters a year getting convicted of arson because they needed something to happen. That's the builder ethos taken to its logical conclusion, and it burns things down. Literally, the distinction the article draws is precise and worth hearing. There's a difference between creating because you have something to build and moving because you can't tolerate stillness. One produces kernels and bridges. The other produces large cookie dough flurries and phone-checking reflexes. The compulsion feels like drive. It isn't. It's escape with better marketing. And the fix is almost comically simple. Sit there. Breathe in. Notice you want to crawl out of your skin. Breathe out. Don't crawl. Do that for 3 breaths, not 30 minutes. The meditation industrial complex has spent decades making this sound mystical. It's not. It's capacity building for your own nervous system. One commenter nails it with the obvious paradox. Isn't trying to get comfortable with doing nothing just another thing to do? Yes. And isn't compiling a compiler just another program to run? You bootstrap with the tools you have. The practice is open. No app required. No subscription. No guru. Just you, sitting there, learning to tolerate the one environment you can never log out of. And once you've optimized the inner loop, let's talk about optimizing the outer one. Pause. Because your development pipeline deserves the same attention. I once spent 3 days debugging a memory leak in a service that handled maybe 40 requests per minute. Meanwhile, our CI pipeline had been failing intermittently for 2 weeks, and nobody had filed a ticket. 40 engineers, each losing maybe 20 minutes a day to flaky builds. Do the math. That's over 13 engineer hours burned daily. My memory leak was costing us nothing by comparison. Jerry Orr's argument is simple enough to fit on an index card. The development pipeline is a production system. When it breaks, your team stops shipping. When your team stops shipping, you have an outage. Treat it like one. Strip this down to first principles. What does a software team actually produce? Working software delivered to users. Every step between intent and deployment is part of that production line. Your issue tracker, your build system, your test suite, your QA environment, your container registry. If any single link fails, throughput drops to zero. The manufacturing world understood this decades ago. You don't let the assembly line stay broken while everyone works on the paint booth. The interesting comment comes from someone who points out the visibility problem. Production outages have dashboards, pagers, incident commanders. When Jenkins is red for 3 days, there's often no alert at all. The cost is real, but distributed. A few minutes here, a contact switch there. Until you aggregate it and realize you've lost a full-time engineer's output to tooling friction. This maps cleanly to open source infrastructure, by the way. The teams I've seen handle this best are the ones running open tool chains they can actually fix. When your build system is a black box SaaS product and it goes down, you file a support ticket and wait. When it's open source, you read the logs, find the commit, and push a patch. Agency over your own pipeline isn't a luxury. It's the difference between an outage you can resolve and one you can only endure. The prescription is almost boring in its obviousness. Monitor your pipeline. Page on failures. Run postmortems. Boring works. But what happens when the tools themselves get smarter? Story 10, 10 advances in mathematics and theoretical computer science. What does it mean for a proof to be beautiful if no human wrote it? That question used to be philosophy. Now it's operational. OpenAI just published 10 results across high-dimensional geometry, coding theory, group theory, quantum complexity, lattice cryptography, and extremal combinatorics. Problems that have been open for a decade or more. Several of them resolving named Erdős problems. The model found the arguments. Humans prepared the manuscripts. Then the model formalized each one in Lean, which means these aren't hand-wavy sketches. They're machine-verified certificates of mathematical truth. Let's be this specific about what's technically impressive here. Non-SoFi groups. That's been a central open question in group theory for years. Disproving Khanna's rigidity conjecture, a long-standing belief about von Neumann algebras. An exponential parallel repetition theorem for quantum games. These aren't incremental improvements. These are the kinds of results that would make a career if a human proved them. Now run this forward 5 years. Imagine a graduate student in Nairobi or Sao Paulo with access to a system like this, not replacing their mathematical intuition, but amplifying it. The way a telescope doesn't replace your eyes, it extends them. The total compute for all 10 problems cost roughly $2,000 at API rates. $2,000 for a decade's worth of open problems. That ratio is extraordinary, and it only moves in one direction. The comments raise a fair point about transparency. We don't know how many problems the model attempted and failed at. Cherry-picking successes is a presentation choice, and OpenAI should be clearer about the denominator. That matters for honest science. But here's what I keep coming back to. The Lean formalizations are open. You can read them, verify them, build on them. The proofs exist independently of who or what generated them. Mathematics has always been the most democratic science because a proof is a proof regardless of who writes it. That principle doesn't change because the author runs on silicon. The real question isn't whether AI can do mathematics. It clearly can. The question is whether these tools stay behind a corporate API or whether the mathematical community gets open models capable of the same work. Because a world where every mathematician on Earth has a research partner that costs $2,000 to run is a world where we solve problems faster than any generation in history. The craft of mathematics isn't diminished by that. It's unleashed. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for August 1st, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Sané, 4.7. Voice by Quen3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go follow the thread that won't let you go. We'll see you back here tomorrow.